Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet Polish pianist Agnieszka Przemyk-Bryła, who will be giving a masterclass and recital as a part of a week-long residency at the University of Tulsa. Przemyk-Bryła is currently an assistant professor at the Frederick Chopin University of Music in Warsaw, which was formerly the Warsaw Conservatory. She's been a first prize winner in the National Frederick Chopin Society Piano Competition in Warsaw in the year 2000. She was a diplomist in the International Chamber Music Competition, a special laureate winner in the 25th Festival of Polish Pianistics, and a final round diplomist in the International Sergei Rachmaninoff Piano Competition in Morricone, Italy in 2003. Our guest today specializes in the music of Chopin and Rachmaninoff, and it's appropriate that on her program Wednesday evening at the University of Tulsa, she'll be playing music by both of those composers, as well as music by Karol Szymanowski. Her recital takes place Wednesday evening at 7:30 in the Gusman Concert Hall of the Lorton Performance Center, and the recital is free and open to the public. She joins me today as our guest on Studio Tulsa. Agnieszka, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Welcome.
And welcome to Tulsa, too. This is very interesting. You came over directly from Warsaw, from your conservatory, to do this recital. How did this come about?
It was in July. I played a concert in Rome with very famous Polish cellist Tomasz Strzal. And it was also a big conference, musicology conference, about Chopin National Edition, where was the professor from here, John Powell. And after have listened our concert, John Powell asked me about we can arrange maybe some performance in Tulsa University. It was just one conversation, and after he found me on the Facebook and he wrote me, and it was like half a year ago. Mm-hmm. And we just, step by step, we have planned everything, and I'm here just for playing this recital and for making masterclass.
Now, do you concertize in the United States very often?
Not very often, but I played, I don't know, maybe 12 times. It was in 2003 and 2004. And I played a concert for Gold Country Piano Institute and Nevada County Composers Cooperative. And it was only in North California and in Santa Cruz.
Now, you mentioned the Chopin National Edition. This is very important, right?
Yes, it's for us Polish, it's really important work by Professor Jan Ekier, who is this year 100 years old. And we will celebrate his anniversary very widely. And I'm involved in Chopin National Edition because I make some works with source commentaries by the style of language and things like that. And I'm a pianist for promote the edition all over the Europe, the world. And
now, for those who are not familiar with the National Edition, what is it exactly?
This is, I believe, I trust, is the best Urtext edition.
It's sort of the authentic, the best sense of what Chopin actually wanted played, right?
Yes, we hope so.
Yeah, and this was subject to lots of debate.
Yes, because there are many people who have some doubts about it, and but we still believe that it's possible these times to find much more sources, much more manuscripts, much more other edition using, of course, internet, and still we can compare many particulars. And now we have the newest thing on the internet is Multimate Chopin website, where you can compose your own music using all the sources we have.
Compose your own music?
Not music, your own sheet of Chopin piece. Ah. And you can choose, for example, pedalization from German edition and the phrasing from French edition, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. So this is new project. Just one piece came out, but the whole team is still working very hardly.
Now, is there nationalistic schools about how you play Chopin? Like, say, somebody who goes through the conservatory system of Poland, are they going to play Chopin a bit different than, say, somebody who went through a French school or an Italian school?
I think that theoretically it's possible to find a way to create some idea about Polish school of performing Chopin, but I think that playing Chopin is something very personal, and it's connected with your soul, with your feeling, with what you have inside you, and all the rules you have to know, they're also for break them if you need. just it's my way of thinking, because music is something much more than the rules.
When you look at something like the Chopin International Competition, you hear the winners from every 5 years there's a competition. And you can hear, say, the winner from 20 years ago playing the piece or one from 10 years ago. The interpretations can be wildly different.
Yes, but I think this is the phenomenon of this music, that it allows to be interpreted in so many ways.
And that's really the beauty of the work.
I think it
really allows the performer to have much more of an interrelationship with the music than you would, say, maybe Beethoven or Brahms or, you know, Clementi or anybody.
Yes. You know, in my opinion, Chopin has to be very sincere and very simply. I mean, in very, I don't know, very good quality way. But you have to open your heart and just play it, not to look for some innovation, some, you know, things which nobody before you played, because it doesn't make any sense. You just have to be clear like a child and feel everything is inside them.
Well, it's interesting, in your program, you're playing the Mazurkas, Opus 59. These are some of my favorite Chopin pieces, and I can't even tell you why, but it just seems like there's something about the melody and the harmony together and the sort of ebb and flow of the rhythm. You know, when you think of a waltz as being more strict, and the Mazurka is a little more personal as far as how it actually flows.
Yes, it's very difficult also to explain, because Mazurka, it's not it's a dance which doesn't exist. I mean, you can just play mazurka. You cannot dance it, because it's stylized dance connected from three other dances. I mean,
now, was the mazurka ever danced to? Was there ever a dance, or was
it? No. Because mazurka is a special dance just for playing. It's connection of three other Polish dances. I can just tell you the names: is Mazur, Oberek, and Kujawiak. And
then you can dance to all three of those.
Yes, all three, but mazurka you cannot, because it's just taking some elements from these dances I told you. And that's why it's so difficult to feel the rhythm, to feel the timing on the mazurka. And I like very much the late Chopin music. That's why I play Barcarolle, I play the Nocturne of Opus 62. Because this philosophy, I don't know, some kind of nostalgia in this music is completely different than from the early Chopin pieces.
Yeah, and all those three works that you mentioned, they seem to take on the personality of the performer a lot of times.
Yeah.
The Nocturne is just this beautiful, beautiful melody, and underneath it, there's this undercurrent of harmonic changes all the time, which is just gorgeous.
Yes, and even the pieces has a major key signature. They have some kind of sad spirit for me. It's not like a joy, just B major, but it's something that, I don't know, passing of time.
And I noticed, you know, when we think of Chopin, you can go in a lot of different directions, but, you know, at some point, like the heroic Polonaise, that's one that often shows up. You're playing the Revolutionary Etude, which is, that's sort of like the pot boiler of Chopin.
True.
Early Etude, but it is a great piece too.
Yes, I like it very much. I played it for more than 20 years, and it's like one of my favorite pieces, which is never boring for me.
Now, growing up in Poland, if you're a piano player, Chopin is probably instilled from a very early age, or do you learn a lot of the Germanic composers first, or is it really Chopin from the very start?
In my family, Chopin was always present, because my mom loves Chopin, and she listened many years ago Chopin competitions. And when I was five, I remember, I was also watching very carefully Chopin competition, and I knew these pieces very early. I knew almost all Chopin music before I came to school. I mean, that's why it was like my roots. And then, of course, I was open for many, many other composers. But Chopin is, every time, I think it's like, for me, like a member of my family.
Now, the Barcarolle, you're playing the Barcarolle, and this just doesn't get performed all that often. You know, it gets performed from time to time, but it's a long piece, and it's showy in its own way.
Yes, and for me, Barcarolle is also some special piece because I really love Italy and everything connected, Italian spirit or Italian music. And of course, Barcarolle is about lovers duo in Venice, let's say. I don't know, everyone can imagine what he wishes, but for me, it's very Italian Chopin's piece, like Tarantelle, like many others. Not all pieces, but the ideas.
My guest today is a pianist, Agnieszka Pyszczymyk Briva. And I apologize, I'm fracturing that a little
it's
bit.
It's difficult, I know.
Yes, but anyway, she is here in Tulsa to present a piano recital Wednesday evening at 7:30 at the Lorton Performance Center, playing all Polish music in the first half, I believe, and then the Rachmaninoff First Piano Sonata in the second half. Now, this was an interesting choice, the Rachmaninoff First. Everybody plays the second.
Yes, me too.
Yes, what attracts you to the first?
Yes, the first sonata is almost unknown. In Poland, I have never seen, I think maybe even nobody plays it in Poland. For me, the main reason was that I wanted to write my doctoral thesis about all Rachmaninoff sonatas. And I played before second, I played cello sonata. And the first one was missing. And I was a little bit afraid because it's a huge piece. It's a very difficult piece. It's not a typical piece for Rachmaninoff because it's a very even with harmonic language, which is not so intense. We have very wide spaces in this sonata, very long phrases.
Critics of the sonata say it's a little repetitive at times.
Yes, it is, but I think it's also.
But it also is sort of inexorable, if you will.
Yeah.
It has to, like a river starts at the source, it has to make its way.
Yes, and for me, the most interesting thing is these three characters, what sonata describes. I mean, Faust, Margaret, and Mephistopheles. Even if Rachmaninoff didn't put it on his first edition, it helps to understand what it's about.
And this, I'm trying to remember when he wrote this. It was after a symphonic failure, I think.
It was just before Third Concerto and Island of the Dead.
Yeah. And so he wrote this, and he was, I don't know what was in his thought process, whether he was going to write a Faust instrumental work at some point, but he wrote a Faust piano sonata.
Yes.
The story of Faust, selling his soul to the devil to win Marguerite. And so this sonata vaguely follows the form, although the program's not anything explicit within the score, is it?
Yes, and Rachmaninoff himself, he told that he wrote a very weird piece and he didn't perform it. Even during the premiere, it was Konstantin Igumnov who performed it for the first time in the world, not Rachmaninoff, and this was really strange. It was,
and considering Rachmaninoff was the consummate composer-performer.
Yes.
I mean, that's how he made his money, was performing his own pieces.
Yes, but he avoided this sonata for all his life.
Why do you suppose?
I don't know, because it's not similar with any other piece. It was written in 1907. It was just after Second Symphony and, as I told before, Island of the Dead and Third Concerto. And comparing with these pieces before and after, maybe it's a little bit not weaker, not
maybe
worse.
Maybe a little more conservative, maybe? Was
maybe.
It maybe reaction to the Second Symphony?
Yes,
reaction?
Such a lot of modal harmonic, such a lot of minor dominant, a lot of. And a very, very huge size. I mean, it was the first version was more than 45 minutes. And then Rachmaninoff cut a part of, but still it's 40 minutes.
And what was the attraction for you as playing it, as you began to learn the piece? What grabs your heart to
yes,
make this?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh. It is. And I think maybe that's why I was feeling like it's just me performing. I mean, I'm only pianist who performs this piece. It was first my motivation. And then I tried, because I know all Rachmaninoff's works, all. I mean, piano and chamber and symphony and choral and all songs, everything. And I really wanted to find a key to this sonata, because it was it's very incredible, impossible that there is a piece of Rachmaninoff which I don't understand. It cannot be true. That's why it was such a long adventure with this.
You think that's maybe the attraction, the fact that it isn't easily understandable as some of his other works are? I mean, when you go through the rest of the...
Of course.
There's a logic to a lot of his works that show up.
Yes. You know, it's a very complicated answer to this question, because the sonata is still, even with this large size, is very intense. I mean, they are not empty moments when you can have rest. You have to be still very concentrated, and it's very like a very strong coffee. but, you know, very big, strong coffee for me.
A coffee.
Let's say in this way.
That's great.
And it's a very difficult piece to memorize. It's really horribly difficult.
And why is that? Because of the repetition and the fact that you play these passages several times and it's a little different every time.
Yes, it is. But, you know, for me, this sonata is now one of my best friends. So I'm really happy to be able to play it in here in U.S. And because 10 years ago, I played the second sonata in California. That's, for now, it's like completed.
My guest today is Agnieszka Pszczmyk-Briwa. And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. She'll be presenting a piano recital Wednesday evening at 7:30 at the Lorton Performance Center at the University of Tulsa. She was the first prize winner in the Frederic Chopin National Piano Competition in Warsaw in 2000 and is now teaching at the Chopin University in Warsaw, where she teaches piano mainly, or you teach chamber music? Or
I have two activities on Chopin University, because first, I share the class of piano with Professor Alicja Paleta-Bugaj, who is chair of piano department.
And your teacher.
Yes, my teacher. And then I play also with cellist, the students of Professor Tomasz Strahl. So I do both.
Yeah. And tell us a little about the conservatory. I mean, this is the traditional Warsaw Conservatory. It's now referred to as the Frederic Chopin University of Music. Can you talk a little bit about the training that the conservatory provides, the university provides?
It's difficult to tell in few words. It's the oldest musical university in Europe. It's school where also Chopin was a student. And for now, we still try to develop our offer for students. Now, when we are university, we have some kind of parallel with other European universities. We can exchange students with program Erasmus. And we offer many, many interesting, I guess, materies. Of course, piano, chamber music, but also many theoretical materies. And we have a lot of students. And unfortunately, we have too small building, and still we have the problem to how to increase our space. But I think that the tradition and the prestige of this school still is very attractive.
You mentioned that tradition and the prestige. When we think of a lot of times the old conservatories in Europe, things change very slowly. Has that been the case in Warsaw as far as the approach? Is it sort of old school sort of preparation for your musical students?
We try not to change too much. The entrance exam is still almost the same. You have to play very wide repertoire. During the studies also, we want to make students playing everything, every epoch, also piano concertos, all what is worth to play. And we have a really good department. I mean, professors are also very very famous and still present on the stages in all over the world. That's why maybe we still have a lot of people who want to study.
Well, we'll be looking forward to your program of Rachmaninoff, Chopin, and Szymanowski as well. It'll be Wednesday evening at 7:30 at the Lorton Performance Center. Agnieszka, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Pianist Agnieszka Pszczmyk-Briwa speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's participating in a week-long residency at the University of Tulsa School of Music and will be performing tomorrow evening at 7:30 in the Gussman Concert Hall of the Lorton Performance Center on the TU campus. That recital is free and open to the public, playing music by Shimonovsky, Chopin, and the Sergei Rachmaninoff First Piano Sonata, which we'll hear a bit of, from a live performance in 2011 from Warsaw. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
Little children are often keen to distinguish between what is real and what is make-believe. It's important for them to know the difference. Adults don't care so much. We tend to blur history and legend. And that blurring is much the subject of the fine new book by Glenn Frankel titled The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. The Searchers in question is the 1956 movie directed by John Ford and starring John Wayne. The actor made it look natural, but John Wayne worked long and hard to create the persona of John Wayne. He was influenced heavily by the Western actor Harry Carey, but also by the great stuntman Yakima Canutt. When I interviewed Mr. Canutt for a magazine article I was writing, I asked him if it was true that Mr. Wayne imitated his rolling walk and drawling talk. Yes, he told me, it was true. He said one day on a movie set, I finally turned around to him and said, "Why the hell are you following me around?" The Searchers got a tepid reception when it was released, but now it's considered one of the great movies of all times and perhaps the greatest Western movie. But the first half of the book is about the history that inspired it, what is real. And that became more fascinating to me than the legend of the novel and the movie. Here's the history. Before Texas was part of the United States, it was part of Mexico. And before that, it was the homeland of several Native American tribes, notably the Comanche and the Kiowa, who knew nothing about Mexico or land ownership. What the tribes knew was that this was their ancestral hunting grounds. And white settlers were trickling in, destroying their lives' balance. The Indians so fiercely defended their hunting grounds, the Mexican authorities encouraged even more white settlement as a buffer between them and the tribes. Indian raids and white retaliation escalated into the Texas-Comanche Wars that lasted for decades. Both sides were equally brutal. Both scalped and dismembered corpses. The whites beheaded the Indians and stuck the heads on posts. Murder was rampant. Now, one extended family of white settlers was named Parker, a poor, crude, fanatically religious clan. In 1936, during a Comanche raid on some of the family, a 9-year-old girl named Cynthia Ann was captured. Taking captives was a common practice. Sometimes the captives were adopted into the tribe, sometimes they became wives or slaves, sometimes they were bartered or sold. Cynthia Ann grew up to be a wife of the Comanche warrior who captured her and bore him 3 children. One romantic legend said that she was his favorite wife, a love match. But more likely, according to history, she was a chore wife and spent her days in hard work cleaning and curing buffalo hides. Now, unbeknownst to her, one of her uncles spent 7 years searching for her and then gave up. And then, 24 years later, white Texas Rangers attacked her camp of women and old men, killed most of them, and re-kidnapped her. She fought them until they told her they would kill her if she didn't go with them. It was another disaster for her. Now 33, Cynthia Ann had become a Comanche, known as Keeps Warm Among Us. She was the mother of three. She spoke Comanche and Spanish, but no English. She was reunited with her white family and spent the rest of her life miserable and in mourning, living in a society she knew nothing about. Now, the white society didn't really want her because she represented a fate worse than death. She was a white woman who had known, in the biblical sense, a dark-skinned Indian man. She was, therefore, unclean. She died longing for her sons she had lost. Meanwhile, the Comanche were conquered, not in war so much, but by the American governments approving the slaughter of the Indian source of food and shelter, with the approval of Generals Sherman and Sheridan, buffalo hunters slaughtered 4 million buffalo in this area. Cynthia Ann Parker's eldest son spent years searching for her, too. His name was Quanah. And in an extraordinary gesture of the time, he took her name. It was a time when Native Americans had only one name, but he declared himself to be Quanah Parker. He was tall, handsome, with gray eyes. He wasn't the tribe's primary candidate for leadership because he was half white. But he was such a self-promoter and diplomat, he became known as a peacemaker and the last great chief of the Comanche. Much of his story takes place in Oklahoma. He was among the Indian captives at Fort Sill. Then he built a grand house for himself and his seven wives in Cache, Oklahoma. Now, flash forward. In 1953, a novelist and screenwriter named Alan LeMay wrote a book named The Searchers, based on the historical story of Cynthia Ann. Then it became a movie, filmed not in Texas and Oklahoma where it happened, but in Ford's favorite Monument Valley. There are many reasons we love Westerns and Western heroes, and one is because here is a tough, solitary, independent man who goes against the tide and settles wrongs, often with gun justice. In The Searchers, John Wayne portrays his darkest Western character, a hard man driven by hatred, vengeance, and his own sense of right. It becomes clear that when he finally does rescue his niece, the character based on Cynthia Ann Parker and played by Natalie Wood, he intends to kill her because she is unclean. And yet there is a tough, relentless, odd love about him that we admire. It's a fascinating characterization. One of the bit actors and stuntmen in that movie is Yakima Canutt. His most famous stunt was in another John Wayne movie in 1939 called Stagecoach. He was one of the warriors attacking a stagecoach. He climbs from his charging horse to the galloping six-horse team, is shot, and falls to the ground underneath the thundering stagecoach and horses. He sent me an autographed photo of the stunt. I asked him how much he got paid for that stunt. $100, he said. Mr. Canutt, I said, that's a lot of money for 1939. And he said, little lady, that's a lot of stunt. That's my imitation of Yakima Canutt and John Wayne. And that's history and legend.
Connie Cronley is a local writer, the executive director of Iron Gate, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.